Lecture 2. When Language Began.
It's natural to think that language is part of culture, and of course it is. So one might think that when we talk about the evolution of language, we're talking about the evolution of cultures. But actually, the fact is that there is evidence that at least to some extent, we have a genetic specification for speaking. And of course, by language, I don't mean language on the page. So often if we think of language, the first thing we literates can't help but think of is print. But that, of course, is an artificial and latter-day representation of this speaking. Most languages in the world are only spoken, and language has only been written for a very short time as far as human language goes, as we'll see later in the series. So when we talk about speaking, this is something which, of course, is tied up with culture as time goes by. But ultimately, evidence suggests that when we talk about the natural history of language, we mean it because language seems to be a product of natural selection. So we're talking about Darwin rather than history and culture. And the person who has been most responsible for promulgating this idea is actually Noam Chomsky. Chomsky is best known, of course, as a leftist political writer and pundit. But in linguistics, he's known often as the grandfather of the field. And he has done work that has absolutely nothing to do with the politics. It's as if there are two people. Chomsky is at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And in the late 50s, he proposed an idea that we are genetically specified somewhere in the brain to learn how to speak, that this is part of being human, one of the hallmarks of Homo sapiens in the biological sense. The idea is that there is something called universal grammar with a capital U and a capital G. And this grammar is very specific. It distinguishes between parts of speech, the way it's formulated, and it manages how we use words with one another. And so, for example, you can say, you did what? And then you can also put the what at the front and say, what did you do? So that's all fine and good. But it seems to not always work that way, because you can say, who do you think will say what? Say at the meeting. Who do you think will say what? But you can't say, what who do you think will say? That's just word soup. Well, if you can put what at the front in terms of you did what and what did you do, then how come you can't say, who do you think will say what, and then what who do you think will say? There are reasons for things like that, rather arcane ones from the layman's perspective. But that is what people who study universal grammar writ large work at figuring out. And this universal grammar hypothesis has revolutionized the field. If you get training in formal linguistics nowadays, chances are you're going to have a rather heavy exposure to concepts that are at least based on what Chomsky started, if not the hardcore, precise Chomskyan formulation. And in fact, this sort of thing has a lot more to do with what most linguists study than what it's often thought that linguists do, which is either be translators, which has nothing to do with linguistics, or study the history of words. And the fact is that as tasty as etymologies are, no linguist could get a job being an etymologist, and actually it's quite out of fashion and not something that concerns most modern linguists. Etymology and word histories is not what we do. It's generally what other people do. There is this idea of identifying what it is that allows us to speak. There are many ways of going at that. And in this lecture, I want to discuss some of the sorts of things like that that have been looked at to give us a sense of what this language is that we're going to see proliferating in so many wondrously different forms throughout the world as we go on. The Chomskyan idea is that there are various indications that we must be genetically programmed to do this, rather than that we're imitating people, which is a natural thing to think, or that we very gradually pick this up as a kind of cultural phenomenon based on how dynamically interesting it is to interact with others. His idea is that we've got a good head start based on this blueprint in our minds. And there are various arguments he uses. One of them is generally called the speed of acquisition argument. And that is that all mentally healthy children learn to speak the language that they're exposed to within the first few years of life. You can assume that, say, by 7, a child has the basic language down. That varies across the world more than we're always told. There are some Native American languages where it's said that nobody is really quite competent until they're 10 or 11. But still, the idea is that you learn most languages pretty darn fast. Now, we're all familiar with how hard it is to learn a language as we get older. It becomes a talent. It takes a lot of work for most people. It doesn't take a lot of work for any child unless there's some rather grave problem. Notice that no matter what the personality type, whether that child is particularly bright or particularly not, child learns to speak. It seems that there's some sort of predisposition, remembering, of course, that no matter how long you keep that cat in your lap, no matter how many bananas you give that monkey, they really do not learn how to talk. But somehow, humans always seem to figure it out. So it suggests programming. And also, there is another argument, which is that all humans learn to speak at all, which, if you think about it, they do. And it seems that even when a human has other disabilities, somehow the ability to do this is not one of the things that is consistently damaged. And so, for example, a child or a person can have a severe mental impairment of some kind. And yet, actually, in some of these impairments, the children actually speak more fluently and with more imagination than ordinary people. Or imagine somebody who you might happen to consider fantastically unintelligent for some reason, some non-bright person you may have met. Chances are it's not that they didn't know how to conjugate their verbs. They talked fine. You just saw them, you know, walking into something or, you know, not being able to tell left from right. But they could talk. They could say fluently, "I've always had trouble performing the basic tasks of life," in good English. It seems that there's some independent factor. Everybody, for the most part, talks. Then there is something which is called the critical age hypothesis, and that is that our language learning ability seems to erode as we get older. And so, for example, you notice that small children, if they come to this country as immigrants, learn English perfectly. And so if somebody has come from Pakistan or Ethiopia and they're still wee folks, then they're going to learn English without an accent. Even if they've been speaking Urdu or Amharic or whatever at home, their English is going to be absolutely perfect. And it's actually interesting to see how quickly kids learn this kind of thing. I once lived under an Israeli couple in an apartment, and they brought their kid. I don't have kids yet, so I don't know how old any child is, but if this kid were standing on this podium, he would have been about a yard high. And so, what is it, 3? I don't know. But he only spoke Hebrew in a high piping voice and clearly was fairly fluent in Hebrew. When he moved in, I could not have a conversation with him at all. 6 months later, I could tell him, "Please stop sitting behind the tire of my car. Please take the, you know, etc." And that's because he had picked up English very quickly. His parents had thick accents, and I'm sure they still do. So that is a typical phenomenon. And you can also see the gradation in terms of teenagers. Like, we have many teenagers from, say, Eastern Europe who've come to this country over the past years. And if you come at 16 or 17, you may get very, very good, but you're probably always going to have a bit of an accent, which is probably going to get a little thicker whenever you're tired. And if you're really tired, you start making little mistakes. Then the adults who come over, if you come at 50, unless you're pretty good, very diligent, almost obsessively so, chances are you're only ever going to be so good. Now, that varies with the individual, but there's a clear, very strong tendency. And what's interesting in terms of whether or not we're genetically specified for it is that this parallels a phenomenon in nature, which is that there are maturational stages. And so if a duckling hatches, you can see this in Looney Tunes, it's become folk wisdom, ducklings imprint on something as their mother. And if it's not actually their mother, you know, they'll imprint on a toaster if you make it move enough. And it seems that they are programmed to imprint on what they see during the first period of time out of the shell. Now, if you show some grown-up duck something that's warm and feathered, it's not going to adopt it as its mother. That time is past. That ability wears away. They're programmed to do it at a very particular time. Caterpillars are programmed to go into the butterfly transformation at a particular time. Not immediately. Then there's no such thing as a three-year-old caterpillar. It happens at a certain time. So it might be that we're programmed to learn language early in life, just like the imprinting or the butterfly transformation. And it's even been said that actually maybe the ability withers later, because after we've already gone on and reproduced, then there's no reason for there to be something that stays along that would help us propagate our genes. It's too expensive. And so that's another case of that. And it's interesting to imagine that we might do an experiment where we saw whether or not this is a maturational feature. But of course, it would be very cruel, because you would have to deny a human being the exposure to language that I think anyone deserves. However, there is a case, predictably, unfortunately, pathological, of a child named Jeannie. And she was kept in isolation from human contact from toddlerhood until the age of 13, spending most of her life in a closet, and she was beaten severely if she tried to talk. Now, thankfully, that does not happen on a regular basis, but one must admit that after a case like that has been discovered, one might want to know, after taking care of Jeannie, how did Jeannie talk? And the fact is that Jeannie never really did learn how to talk. So you might think that language is a matter of listening to people around you and learning, picking up some words and throwing them into a bag. But about the best that Jeannie could ever do was things like, I like elephant, eat peanut. She could memorize words, just like, meaning no disrespect to Jeannie, an ape can. But using grammar was something where apparently it was too late, and she wanted to, but couldn't. So it suggests that there is some sort of particular time, and that is a hallmark of genetically specified traits. Then there's another argument, which is ingenious. It's highly contested, but it's ingenious. The poverty of the stimulus argument that Chomsky uses. And that is that humans seem to learn language without being taught, for the most part, despite the fact that actual language is very messy. And it's very easy to lose sight of that, because as literates, we are so trained to think of language on the page. And there's a piece of a lot of us that thinks that we talk like what's on the page more than we do. Language is inherently a kind of a choppy, baggy affair. One linguist has estimated that in general we speak in chunks of about 7 words apiece, linked together by ands and ors and thens. Now, you can take the way language is really spoken and fashion it into the elegance and the tidiness of the written page, but that's just kind of an artifice. And if any of you have ever done the college dorm trick of putting the tape recorder on and letting it roll for an hour and then playing how you and your friends sound, often that turns out to be shocking in how utterly inarticulate everybody seems. We don't tend to speak in full sentences and paragraphs, and anyone who does stands out. That's an odd trait. That's like plaid pants. Anybody who really does talk in paragraphs. So, spoken language tends to go something like this. This is actually a recording from the 70s of college students talking at a perfectly respectable school, perfectly intelligent kids. This is exactly what they said. So it's not a written cleaning up of what they said. This is actually them. One of them says, yeah, it doesn't help the tree, but it protects, keeps the moisture in. Because then it just soaks up moisture. It works by the water molecules adhere to the carbon molecules that are in the ashes. It holds it on. The plant takes it away from there. If you think about it, that's how people talk. If you imagine walking through a mall and listening to what people are saying, this is the way people talk in academic hallways. It's just human speech. Another person said, you know, you said how silly it was about my, well, it's not a theory at all, that the more pregnant you are and you see spots before your eyes, it's proven that it's the retention of the water. That's normal. People talk like that in all languages all over the world. Context takes care of a lot. You're drinking something, you have other thoughts, you laugh, you clear your throat. That's what kids are exposed to, according to the Chomskyan hypothesis. And so how is it that you actually do learn how to say, what who do you think will say, given the fact that this is the stimulus that you get? It suggests that there's some sort of head start in there. And finally, there is specific language deficits. It seems that if there is some sort of damage to what one supposes might be a language organ in our brains, it's not just that all of a sudden people don't talk right. It gets almost amazingly specific what happens depending on what part of the brain is affected. So, for example, there is one area called Broca's area. And Broca's area seems to have something to do with controlling grammar, what the layman often calls syntax. For example, the word order, how the words are placed with one another. And it's not absolutely consistent, but with to a degree that is obviously more than an accident. If that's the part that got hurt, then there seemed to be problems with grammar. So one person who had Broca's damage would be given to saying things like, yes, Monday, Dad and Peter Hogan and Dad hospital, and Wednesday, 9 o'clock, and Thursday, 10 o'clock, doctors, two, and doctors, and teeth. Yeah, that's an actual passage of somebody with Broca's. So they've got words, but they just don't know what to do with them. That's clearly somebody who's thinking something, but that's the best that they can do. So with one area, you get that. What's interesting is the contrast. There's another area, somewhat below the Broca's area, and that is Wernicke's area. And there, the issue seems to be not what you would call your syntax, but meaning and comprehension, the semantics. And so syntax is fine. You can rub a noun and a verb together for days, but it's just that you can't make any darn sense. And so here is one Wernicke's person. Damage in that area, and typical of their speech was, oh, sure, go ahead, any old thing you want. If I could, I would. I'm taking the word the wrong way to say all the barbers here, whenever they stop you, it's going round and around, if you know what I mean. That is tying and tying for repusseration. Well, we were trying the best that we could. The grammar is fine, but it's just that none of it means anything. And this is not somebody playing, and it wasn't a child. It was a very frustrated person who had a particular kind of brain damage. So many people would say, many people are tempted to say that language is culture, or language is just a matter of imitation, just like everything else. But the problem is that if that's true, if there isn't some sort of specific organ for language in the brain rather than it just being a part of culture, or as many people think, just a part of general thought processes and learning processes and cognition, then why is it that if you hurt this one area, one aspect of this thing called language is hurt, and if you hit another one, a different aspect is? So something seems to be going on there more than we are often taught. So a lot of research has been done over the past 30 years trying to identify whether or not we have a genetic specification for language. And as we get better and better at identifying genes in our DNA, we're advancing by leaps and bounds to a certain extent in identifying whether we are genetically specified for this thing. One of the most interesting examples was a discovery by Myrna Gopnik, who is a McGill University linguist. And she has documented a family in England, and it's a multi-generational family. And it's unique because various people in this family just don't speak well. Now, some people are more articulate than others, but there's some people where there really does seem to be a slight problem. Some of the people in this family make mistakes like the man fall off of the tree, which is kind of, that's not just inarticulate, that's just outright wrong, and you wonder why anybody would do that. Or something like the boys eat four cookie without the plural marker. Now, that's not bad grammar, that's just bizarre. There are all sorts of things which, wrongly, we are taught are errors, in my opinion. We'll get to that in a later lecture. But very rarely do we have to tell somebody, you must remember to mark that for plural. Everybody does that. But here are people who just say, the boys eat four cookie. Now, in real life, it's just thought, those people don't talk right. But if you're a scientist, you give it a name, and it's been called specific language impairment. And it does seem to be a very specific condition. And so you'll take somebody, an ordinary person who's, got a house with pictures on the wall and some job and milk in the refrigerator and cat sit them down, and you show them a picture of something, and you say, now this, I'm going to make up the name of the person, this daisy is called a wug, and it's just this little thing. Now, Daisy, here's another picture, and it's a picture where there are three of these things. Now, if this daisy is a wug, then what's this picture of? Now, most of us would immediately say wugs, or three wugs. Daisy says, well, oh dear. Literally, she's one of them said, well, oh dear. And then one of them said, wugness? And that's really the best they can do. There's something wrong. Now, you might think, gosh, you know, then they're just not very bright. But the thing is, they're of normal intelligence. They just can't talk. Now, as it turns out, wouldn't you know that there is a gene that has been identified that seems very closely connected to our ability to speak? It's called FOXP2. And there is a kink in FOXP2 in the members of this family that have this problem and not in the others. So clearly there's something going on. So that's another one that makes it hard to uphold what in academia outside of certain circles of linguistics is a fashionable notion that language is really just part of cognition and culture and that there's nothing specific, nothing more than that. Because that what went on with that family seems pretty indicative. Now, even more we see about FOXP2 is with apes. The cleanest thing would be if only humans had FOXP2, then it would be Eureka. But actually, if you look at chimpanzees and some other apes, they have a very FOXP2-like gene. It's not like ours, which suggests, and talk about the wonder of these sorts of things. I can't wait to see how it's going to turn out. But apparently, these very slight differences in what kind of proteins these genes make somehow determines the difference between or whatever chimpanzees do and what we're doing. How? Why? It's a marvel. I know I'll look quaint saying this in 20 years, but at this point, from the vista of 2004, that is a truly fascinating possibility. But there does seem to be something going on. Now, I'm probably supposed to stop there, but really, to be fair, one has to look at the counter evidence to the Chomsky hypothesis, which is considerable and highly unattended to by the people who do Chomskyan linguistics. There's some problems with it. So, for example, you say that you're amazed at how quickly humans learn language. And it is really something watching how quickly a kid picks it up. But you could also say that it's interesting how quickly a child learns to pour liquid into a container. Not the easiest thing in the world. Your cat couldn't do it. Your cat couldn't do it if you somehow gave it opposable thumbs. You can just tell that as graceful as they are, the cat would spill it all over the place again and again, even if it wanted to do it. That's pretty specific. Or throwing a ball with aim. That's pretty good. Chimp can throw a ball, but in terms of actually getting it to a certain point, well, we have a kind of a higher cognition. Jumping rope, kids learn that fast. I never could do it, partly because I'm male, but partly because I don't think I would have been good at it if I were female and culturally inclined to do it. And yet, we don't say that anybody is genetically specified for jumping rope. And so maybe it's just that humans are pretty darn smart. Specific language impairment. It's like the little part of the story that you tend not to hear because the other part is more fun. Other people have looked at this family, and it turns out that actually, to put it delicately, the ones who have the specific language impairment generally are not extremely intelligent. More specifically, there seems to be a little bit of a problem. So that doesn't mean that there is no language gene, but it might be more complicated than that. There does seem to be an intelligence gradient that happened to be missed by the first researchers. Then there is the poverty of the stimulus argument that I gave, which is that language is so choppy, which it very often is, but it isn't always. If any of you were thinking, I don't talk like that, to an extent, yes, you do. Listen to yourself when this is over. I certainly talk like that offline. But on the other hand, if you're thinking I don't always talk like that, there's a point to it. And there are various people who are studying the input actually given to children, as it's put in the biz. And a lot of them are finding a lot less of that hopeless choppiness than the Chomskyans conclude. And the fact is that the factoids that I've given you, poverty of the stimulus and the maturational issue, those things have been repeated again and again and again, but by most of the specialists with very little actual demonstration. There is an extent to which any scientific movement is partly a religion, and that is definitely true of the Chomskyans. They want to find this. They're stimulated by this idea. As far as the counter evidence, most of them are too busy writing grants to pay much attention. And if you actually do examine what's going on, then there are some questions. So if you are further concerned with this issue, what most linguists say is to read Steven Pinker's book, The Language Instinct. That book is brilliant. It's wonderful. If it runs a tad long, I urge you to read it all the way through, because that's the only way to get the whole message. Divide it up into chunks beforehand and make sure to get the whole book. And that is probably the most readable and marvelous argument for the Chomskyan hypothesis to be written. So that's a good one. It was not a bestseller for nothing. It should be read, unlike most bestsellers that are nonfiction. On the other hand, there's another one that everybody should read to really make their minds up for themselves. Jeffrey Sampson, less famous than Steve Pinker, wrote a book called Educating Eve, The Language Instinct Debate. Now, that's not a great title. I mean, what is Educating Eve about? Your mind immediately moves on to the next book. But as it happens, it is a careful step-by-step address of not only Steve Pinker's arguments, but the Chomskyan's arguments. He's got that kind of British wit, and so it's a pleasant read. It's kind of thin. And to really come to a conclusion as an interested person, you read Pinker, then you go on Amazon and see if Sampson is still in print. Because, of course, that one isn't famous, but it's really the equal counterbalance. Now, on the other hand, whether or not we actually have grammar imprinted in our heads, and the jury is very much out on this at this point, I think it's pretty safe to say that it's pretty clear that we are genetically programmed to talk to some extent. For example, if we weren't, wouldn't there be at least one group of humans who didn't talk? You could go to Botswana and look behind some reeds or something and find this very small group of people where they do everything we do. They're dancing, they're eating, they're wearing clothes and making art, but they never got around to talking. That, you know, cultural diversity, they just don't do that. But all people seem to do it, which suggests that it's something universal enough to be a genetic specification. Babies babble instinctively. They always make noise. There's no such thing as a baby that doesn't start going, nah, 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 nah. It almost seems like they're trying to talk. And they eventually learn to speak. And again, you contrast that with animals in that no matter how much time you spend with animals, they're listening to you. They often love you. Dogs even can learn a bunch of words, but they don't speak, nor can you give a dog sentences. I was on a TV show not recently where there is a chimpanzee on it, and I was bored in between takes, and so I went behind the set and played with the chimpanzee. Chimpanzee had like 8,000 handlers, all for this thing in a diaper. And I said, well, you know, can you talk to it? You know, how much language does it have? Because it had these soulful eyes. And they said, oh, it can understand as much language as an 8-year-old. No, it couldn't. I mean, frankly, if it could understand that much, it would have known what we were saying right then. It didn't understand a thing anybody was saying, except I think it did have banana and get down, something like that. And that ape is with people all the time. Kids do better than that in terms of comprehension. So clearly, there's something going on. So just when this ability emerged is currently unknown, but we can be pretty sure that it had happened before humans migrated out of Africa, and that gave the world the gift of speech that we know in humans now. And what's interesting, just to leave you with a parting thought, is that the Chomskyan hypothesis is very controversial in the field. And in fact, especially among many people, especially educated, literate people, there is almost a repulsion towards the idea that we might be genetically specified for language. People resist this. There are certain kinds of linguists whose hair stands up on end at the very notion that language is not all about the people who speak it and sociality and culture. The idea that it might be some arrangement of neurons and that these neurons fashion language according to some very abstract kinds of principles that don't have anything to do with history or culture or the human psychology is deeply unpleasant. There are times in linguistics where the fighting along these lines gets almost unseemly. Many people talk about Noam Chomsky and these ideas as some sort of scourge. I'm just giving you how this stuff goes, but it's almost politicized in the field. In general, many people, especially people who kind of read around, hate the idea that we might be genetically specified for it. We know that we're genetically specified for all sorts of other things, but the notion that language might be imprinted in our brains and not something cultural. It's not about food and getting along with people and coffee cups and history and power relationships, etc., is deeply disturbing. I've always found that interesting. And in parting, does that notion disturb you? Do you find something unpleasantly sterile about that? Does it seem to leave out part of the picture? Because actually, if we could find out that there is a genetic specification and know exactly what it was, we could not only fix brain damaged people in terms of their speaking capabilities, but it would be really, really neat. And yet there are a great many people in linguistics and in the humanities who would rather hear nothing less than that.